Most of you know there are certain key spots on this earth that we're focusing in on, and certain subjects that the reason they remain the mystery they are, they may always remain a mystery to a degree, but the reason they remain the mystery that they are, nobody gestalts them. In the age of specialization, everybody is approaching this world and its hidden mysteries, to put it one way, like the four blind men who ran into an elephant. One hits a leg, another hits the trunk. I don't go on these subjects at random. They're connected. Now, I have finally decided to start touching the subject of demonology. And like so many subjects, I'm tired of it being the province of the nuts. Until if you even get on the subject, you're immediately categorized by the audience as one of these freakos. Now, I got 9 years to prove I don't do this often. It's a tool. It's a credential. I think it's necessary to use it at this point. And in case somebody's listening that doesn't know it, I did a PhD at Stanford University in philosophies of education. My undergraduate major was history. I read for the political science prof. Minored in the physical sciences, not physical ed, the physical sciences. Determined to do a PhD at the University of California in cultural geography because the department at that time was combining anthropology and geography and geology together in a unique way. I was doing my undergraduate work at Chico State University. In those days, they only offered a master's in the teaching of social sciences. So I did a master's in the teaching of social sciences, qualifying me in California to teach junior college down in those subjects. But because I was going to do the PhD at Cal, I thought, I coordinated, and at the same time took enough extra work to fulfill the unit requirements for a major in geology. Without boring you with the reasons, an event changed my direction totally and I started over. At the PhD level at Stanford University in philosophies of education, they were doing experiments in those days with what some were calling humanities degrees. That's become a bad word in some circles. And you could work cross-departmental. My dissertation committee included Lex Miller, the New Zealand theologian, who had studied under Barth, Karl Barth in Germany, and had been Niebuhr's assistant at Union, heading the religion department at Stanford. Famous worldwide as the New Zealand ethical theologian. Professor Cowley, who was Lon Jack's professor there, who had been past president of the University of Michigan and had pioneered a taxonomy, to use the technical word, for the analysis of social institutions, particularly higher education institutions. Larry Thomas, past president of American Philosophy of Education Teachers, was my major prof, thoroughgoing experimentalist, student and disciple of John Dewey in those days. So my education crossed so many different fields, and I'm glad I ended up in the philosophy world. Because I've done so much geography, I'm probably the only one on record at Stanford University who petitioned to get the PhD minor that would have required a full year of classwork, additional graduate work, in geography. saying there were no classes there that I hadn't covered in my preparation for Cal, and I petitioned to have the minor granted by an oral exam, and it was. I took the oral exam, passed it, and received a PhD in PhD minor in geography from Stanford University, and never took a class at Stanford in geography. That freed a year. Dr. Kishimoto, who took Amasaki's place as the leading Buddhist scholar in the world, Kishimoto took his place from University of Tokyo. His specialty, he was the leading scholar in the world. Amasaki had been the Buddhist scholar. Kishimoto took his place, but Kishimoto was a specialist in mountain worship in Japan. I took my basic comparative religion classes under Spiegelberg at Stanford, whose expertise in the Vedanta religions of India that are the basis of Buddhism, probably he's without a peer in American universities. He fascinated me much as Kishimoto did, because he had what's recognized as the world's largest Tibetan ghost trap collection. Now, I collect things. That's one that I coveted. Kishimoto was here for 5 years, 1 year at Union, 1 year at Yale, 1 year at Princeton, 1 year at Harvard, and 1 year at Stanford. A five-year special study to study religions in America. In his opening class, which was billed as a comparison between the development of Buddhology and the development of Christology, I began to challenge his presentation properly and with respect. But the analogy didn't fly. You can plot the development of Buddhology and the denial by the followers of Buddha of Buddha's own messages that decried and denied any divinity. In the Samgitas, meetings of his followers every 200 years after his death, they ultimately concluded, and you can plot the historic point where the followers of Buddha determined, even though he denied divinity, that he could not have done and said what he did unless he was divine. And you can find the point where they stamp divinity on him, historically. By contrast, the Christian message begins with a supernatural proclamation. There would have been no Christianity without the proclamation of the resurrection going out the gate. And by contrast, it was later demythologizers who tried to separate the divinity consciousness out of the stream of Christianity. And when I challenged in the paper Dr. Kishimoto on the point, he began to quiz me on my religious background. I was invited to a year of individual study with him. Some of the classes, I shared it with Hideo Aoki, a Free Methodist friend who was working on his doctorate in the same departments, subsequently to become the head of the Japanese Evangelical Missionary Society in Tokyo. And I think one of the great accidents, some people would call it, one of those little miracles of my life, was in 1963 or four, thereabouts. I graduated from Stanford with a PhD in 1957, and I was on a world tour, most of it in the Orient, and I just finished some 7, 8, 9 weeks in the backcountry of the Philippines and all over the Orient. And I came back through Tokyo and I went to dinner in a restaurant, and when you know how big Tokyo is, and I hadn't seen Hideo Aoki since leaving Stanford University, and I hear my name called and turn around, and here is the friend that I had labored through our graduate program and an individual study with Dr. Kishimoto, sitting in the same restaurant, which may not interest you, but I just remember that that was one of those little indices that God leads his people. Because that could have been no accident. And it was a time where he needed to share some things. And we spent that evening reminiscing and I think helping one another. But back to Kishimoto. I spent a year in individual study because he had come to study religion in this country and he had been steered away from the primitive expressions of evangelical Christianity, only shown the high church liturgical expressions. So I spent the whole year laying the basis of my faith on him and him responding from the Oriental religious frame. All of this, I think, prepared me for this day, but I tell you that so those who listen will not write me off as some nut when I get on demonology. I've traveled this world over. I've watched headhunters perform, or not headhunters, but the witch doctors. I never want to see headhunters perform. The witch doctors among headhunting tribes north of Baguio and northern Luzon. I've attended scary Kali services north of Calcutta. I spent weeks in the backcountry above Pune, out of Bombay. I covered every country in Central and South America in 6 weeks' time, say Paraguay, and could throw a rock toward it from Iguazu Falls. I've watched demon worship in Haiti. I have attended not the tourists, but the spiritus service, the Rio McCoy in Brazil, where we have an orphanage. I have seen the reality of demon power. An academician though I may be, I know the reality of the supernatural. In the Christian frame, I belittle the shoddy imitations of God's performance because I know how real God can be. Likewise, don't think you can reduce Satan down to backward records. And I arrived in Australia in time to correct some of the extremism of the demonology splurge of about 10 years ago, I guess it was, to be exact, where they were taking all the saints and whatever ailment you had was a demon, and you spit them out on little napkins. I've seen the nuts. I think it's time we get in on it and try to sort some of this subject matter out. I don't want to create fear, but one of the devil's tactics is to make you think he doesn't exist. I was very kind to Canon Brian Green because I love him and I owe him a great debt. But the demons you would meet in university are rather subtle. You might get away with calling them a force. But in the backcountry where I've worked with missionaries, they take the gloves off. Now, do you believe in demons, you say? Well, I believe in some. And the honest answer is, yeah, I believe in demons. Now, before I get into this ghost story, we talk of Glastonbury, the Gate of Remembrance. One of the greatest scholars of the Glastonbury area was Frederick Bly Bond. He'll be called in this book FBB. His associate also goes by an initial. I'm trying to find, John Elaine is his name. Do you know about automatism or automatism? You got it, John? It's where they call them sitters. As they took readings of Edgar Casey, who in his sleep would talk and then write things down. In this case, they call them sitters. In automatism, in a sitter experience, they sit and they write the messages in a state almost equivalent to a seance. Bond had his career ruined, settled in America, later went to Wales, died in 1945. Totally an outcast from the ecclesiastical machinery and operation of the Anglican Church. Why? It was on the 7th of November that FBB, that's Bond, and J.A., John Allen, had their first sitting for the purpose of furthering the Glastonbury research. This took place at 4:30 p.m. in Bond's office. J.A. held a pencil. FBB provided foolscap paper, which he steadied with his left hand whilst placing his right hand lightly on the back of J.A.'s so that his fingers lay evenly across its surface. FBB started by asking the question as though addressed to some other person. Can you tell us anything about Glastonbury? Frederick Bligh Bond, The Gate of Remembrance. J.A.'s fingers began to move, and one or two lines of small, irregular writings were traced on the paper. He didn't see what he had written, nor did FBB decipher it until complete. The agreed method was to remain passive, avoid concentration of the mind on the subject of writing, and to talk casually of other and indifferent matters, and this was done. The writing turned out to be a sort of abstract dictum. All knowledge is eternal, is available to mental sympathy. Then followed. I was not in sympathy with monks. I cannot find a monk yet. FBB, are you interested in this?
Yes, sir.
I can tell you the end of the story. They traced out a design of Glastonbury that found the lost chapel. And after this source of information found a monk, because he wasn't too friendly with monks, a monk who was there at the time told him. And they wrote out a design, a whole new chapel. Now, when the abbey was destroyed in the 1500s, they had sort of drawn dotted lines as though a section of Glastonbury ended at a certain point. But all of a sudden, a whole lost chapel was drawn out by this monk who knew about it. They ostracized Bligh and Allen and threw them out, except archaeologists in recent years dug and found exactly what had been drawn out through the automatism. Now, I'd like to read the discussion with this monk, but we're going to be leaving some of the stations, and then I'll be right back. If you'd like me to continue, call me. I mean, this is number four we got dangling now, and I want to tell the ghost stories right after 10 o'clock West Coast time. The songs I want to know. I am looking at the supernatural. Now, I gave a speech that's not normal to me of my credentials and background in the previous hour, only to make sure that I don't get tuned out while I get on this subject because you think I'm some kind of nut. I'm an academician. Did a PhD at Stanford University in philosophies of education. And as we look at the Azores and the Bermuda Triangle and Atlantis and the pyramid and the world that then was before the flood and the sons of God who came down and cohabitated with the women, the daughters of men, as we look at demonology in the Old and New Testament, you've got to conclude there's some powerful beings moving around out there. Now, demonology usually starts with things like the exorcist. But there are some ways to approach the subject other than a girl vomiting on the bed. Here's a little book, The Gate of Remembrance, by Frederick Bly Bond. It's about Glastonbury, but it's like no other book you've ever read about Glastonbury. Frederick Bly Bond was ostracized, died in 1945 in Wales. Professional career ruined because he dared to report on a happening while he was involved in the study and research about Glastonbury that caused the established church community to ostracize him as either a fraud or a nut. He did research on Glastonbury, not with a shovel, but rather utilizing psychical research, parapsychology, automatism. Now, automatism, you have a sitter who somehow tunes in on a source of information and writes. I'll show you what some of the earliest writing looked like. It didn't come through quite as clear going out the gate. And you can see, it sort of looks like blindfold writing. It never picks the pen up. You've got to stay back, Mike, until you can see it's just one continuous, like they start with some lines over here and just keep going. Here we go. Lines, and then over, and then back, and then up and around. And then the general rough structure of Glastonbury's shape and size was drawn, and then some words were written in. Now, this extension on Glastonbury here didn't exist in the minds of those who had studied and dug for years. Glastonbury was always viewed by the archaeologists like so. The cathedral, and when you get up to the end of the cathedral, it always would just shut off with a dotted line as though it ended. Well, this research through automatism continued to clarify and emphasize a chapel that didn't exist in the drawings. It got clearer as they went along. The purpose of me reading it, though I'm interested in Glastonbury for other reasons, is to simply add a little bit of further evidence of an extra sensory parapsychological extra normal dimension of happenings. We've been reading strange things going on in the Bermuda Triangle. I don't want to do the wooden-headed thing that most people do, write off everything you can't explain to the supernatural. But neither do I want to do the equally wooden-headed limitation on research that says there can be no supernatural explanation. A scholar keeps his mind open. Now, you explain this happening. It was on the 7th of November that FBB, that's Bly, and JA, that's John Allen, had their first sitting for the purpose of furthering the Glastonbury research. And this is what he is ostracized for. Now, I can tell you, he was ostracized because he claimed that there had been revealed to them the existence of a chapel that the archaeologists and historians said didn't exist, a lost chapel. His writings are now important because after he was ostracized, other kinds of scientific research dug up the chapel. Now, how did he know? He claimed this is the way he knew. It was on the 7th of November that FBB and JA had their first sitting for the purpose of furthering the Glastonbury research. This took place at 4:30 p.m. in FBB's office. J.A., John Allen, held a pencil. FBB provided foolscap paper, which he steadied with his left hand, while placing his right lightly on the back of J.A.'s, so that the fingers lay evenly across its surface. And J.A.'s holding the pencil. Bly steadies the paper and puts his other hand on the back of J.A.'s hand. FBB started by asking the question as though addressed to some other person. Now go in this room and see these two grown men going through this. Can you tell us anything about Glastonbury? J.A.'s fingers began to move. And one or two lines of small, irregular writing were traced on the paper. He did not see what was written, nor did FBB decipher it until complete. The agreed method was to remain passive, avoid concentration of the mind on the subject of the writing, and to talk casually of other and indifferent matters. And this was done. The writing turned out to be a sort of abstract dictum, namely, quote, all knowledge is eternal and is available to mental sympathy, end quote. Then followed, as though whomever they addressed was explaining why an immediate answer about Glastonbury wasn't ready. The hands moving, writing the answer. I was not in sympathy with monks. I cannot find a monk yet. FBB suggested that one of their living monk friends might be a sympathetic link. And the writing was resumed. After a short interval, J.A.'s hand moved and began to trace a line, ultimately making a drawing which on inspection looked like a recumbent cross, but which when examined proved to be a fairly correct outline of the main features of the Abbey Church at Glastonbury, traced by a single continuous line. But at the east was a long rectangular addition, nearly as long again as the choir, and this was given in a double line as though to emphasize it. Down the middle of the plan were written the words, Guliumus Monachus. Let's look at it again. Guliumus Monachus. And that's not the chapel. I told you wrong before. It's over here with the double lines, the extension. It's on. This is the top of the cross as the chapel's laid out. And here's the extension. And written, Guliumus Monachus. Hand scrawled. Am I boring you?
No, sir.
Next followed what appeared to be an elaborate plan of the great enclosure of the Abbey Church, with a sketch of a central tower. Now they asked, can you tell us anything about Glastonbury? Next followed what appeared to be, it's too hot now. Next followed what appeared to be an elaborate plan of the great enclosure of the Abbey Church, with a sketch of a central tower with square pinnacled top, a west front or gabled facade, with two peaked turrets and a large arched light between. Across the middle of the surrounding enclosure, a line was drawn. I mean, there's some guys out there just dig like hell to find this. And sweat? No, they're doing is holding hands. Across the middle of the surrounding enclosure, a line was drawn. At one point, something like an ornamental turret with two curved diverging lines below appeared, and the words linea bifurcata were written. Now, why would those lines be written? It may interest you to know that the ancient Book of Melkin, now lost but quoted by John of Glaston, says of Joseph of Arimathea. Now, the moving hands are only writing first that little cryptic phrase, and then I never liked monks, so I can't find one right now. And then a drawing of the abbey, Gulius Monachus, or Guliomus Monachus, is written. Then all of a sudden the words linea bifurcata. Bong! Research connects to other places. The ancient Book of Melkin, now lost, quoted by John of Glaston, says of Joseph of Arimathea. Amongst them, Joseph of Marmore, named of Arimathea, receives perpetual sleep, and he lies in linea bifurcata near the south corner of the oratory, which is built of hurdles. Linea, according to Duquesne, means an undergarment. Bifurcata would denote one slit at the sides, like a shirt or a dalmatic. But our script here seems to suggest, rather, a fork in the paths as the place where Joseph lay. More importantly, another tie-in to all that wealth of substantial material that says Joseph of Arimathea ended up at Glastonbury, the early apostle of Britain. And again, you know, as you scan with Gestalt, you don't build your case on just one little statement here or there. Then something looking like a gable building was sketched, from which a line was traced to two rows of arches, perhaps representing a cloister. Thence another straight line to a drawing recognized as being intended for St. Mary's Chapel and approaching it from the south. The plan of the chapel showed a large square projection, maybe a turret, on the south and two doors on the north side. Question. Well, it hands a question by Bly. What does this drawing represent? Answer, written out. Guest hall, St. Maria Capella, Rolf Monachus. The first drawing was now examined. Both FBB and JA expressed a view unfavorable to the possibility of so large a chapel at the east of the church. They must be getting wrong signals. It was resolved to try again. Bly asked the question. Am I boring you?
No, sir.
Hands moving. Please give us a more careful drawing of the chapel sketch just now at the east end of the great church. That Bly and John Allen simply didn't believe could exist. In reply, a new sketch of the rectangular chapel was given, with an attempt to indicate the position of the two smaller chapels on the north. Again, the line was drawn double, and below was written the following in cramped characters not easy to decipher. A whole bunch of them. I won't bother to read all of the cryptic message. But there's the picture. I might tell you that this is what archaeologists subsequently uncovered of the chapel that wasn't supposed to exist. Please repeat, Bly said. We can't read this. Repetition. Please give length again. More detail. Which abbot did this? Ricardus, answer. Ricardus Whiting, Ego Johannes Bryant Monachus et Lapidator. This concluded the sitting. November 11th, 1907. It's too hot in here. 1 p.m. November 13, 1907. A series of writings, sittings with writings. And then, strange for someone that was trying to fabricate something, the writings begin to show a certain bit of uncertainty. The writings indicating whomever was responding to their request, tell us about Glastonbury, and answering the questions, is communicating that to them through this automatism of writing in this city. But the spokesperson from beyond, for want of a better term, begins to show less than perfect ability to answer their question. Quote, I think I am wrong in some things. Other influences cross my own. Those monks are trying to make themselves felt by you both. Why do they want to talk Latin? Why can't they talk English? I mean, the poor guy over there in the beyond that didn't like monks and couldn't find one right away so he could talk to them, but eventually started giving these messages, now shows a little bit of irritation that I think I am wrong in some things. Other influences cross my own. Those monks are trying to make themselves felt by you both. They want you both to feel them. Why do they want to talk Latin? Why can't they talk English? Benedicity. Johannes. It's difficult to talk in Latin tongue. Seems just as difficult to talk in Latin language. Ye names of builded things are very hard in Latin tongue. Transome, fan tracery, and the like. My son, thou canst not understand. We would speak in the English tongue. We said that ye volt was multipart, yet was fans old style in ye east end of ye choir, and ye now volt in Edgar's chapel. Gloucester fans repeated fans, Johannes Lapmason, signed. The signature's put on. Who's doing the talking? Johannes Lapmason. Well, question, what is meant by Lapmason? Answer. Lapidator, stonemason. Having this signature, Johannes, now again repeated, FBB, that's Bly, felt curious to know how far this dramatization or memory of a personality might be developed. So he questioned. Up till now, they'd asked, can you tell us anything about Glastonbury? Tell us more about yourself. Answer, I died in 1533. This is 1907. November 13th, 1907. Tell us more about yourself. I died in 1533. Plus a bunch more comments. Who was this Johannes? Well, whoever he was right. Now, what continues are sittings. He talks about things that went on. Other monks get in on it and talk, give them details, describe that chapel, that lost chapel. And when Bly tells it to the churchmen, because he was in a frame where they believed the devil's a force, and no such beyond communications could occur, not suggesting they're all the devil, just something beyond. He was ostracized by the church. But they kept digging, and I'll show you the picture again. They dug it up. One of the things that was described in detail, you'll notice that off on one side of the chapel, if you get in close enough, there's a little annex that it has a slanting wall, not perpendicular to the ground, but slanting, described in detail by one of these monks from beyond. They not only dug it up, it was exactly as it had been described. You remember the girl with the Ouija board and the house that came under attack? That's the iron pipe on the roof that got bent. It'd take a truck to bend it. The bureau drawers in Ted and Ellen Dunneman's bedroom would open and slam shut of their own accord. More than once, when their son Brian slept on the floor in a sleeping bag, letting the Warrens have the room, the drawers would become active and slam him on the head. The day begins each morning with when the Donovans woke up. The bathroom would be torn apart. The towels were often found stuffed in the toilet. Part of the demonic strategy is to rain objects of particular value or ruin objects of particular value to the victim. As soon as Ed Warren complimented the Donovans on their carnival glass fruit bowl, it levitated into the air, then crashed onto the floor. If somebody showed me these pictures without the background of who the Warrens were, and the background of what we're doing, I'd say, get lost. Don't give me that kind of baloney. But you got to know the Warrens. Part of the normal disarray in the Donovan household, freshly made beds have been partly torn apart. Later each day, these bed linens would rise to the ceiling and fall back in a heap on the bed. The spirit Patty Donovan contacted on the Ouija board left mementos on her bed every day. Here it has transported a door removed, a pocketbook from storage, and dumped garbage from the kitchen, bathroom, and laundry room all on her bed. Remember the crypt and the Bermuda Triangle that nobody could explain about all the caskets moved around that took eight men to move one of them? Ed Warren inspects the refrigerator. Now, if I hadn't given you a little bit of Ed Warren's credentials, I'd expect you to turn this off right now and say, this guy's crazy. Ed Warren inspects the refrigerator, which has spontaneously been levitated away from the wall at a 90-degree angle. The kitchen chair arrived atop the appliance courtesy of the same mysterious force. Kitchen chair upside down on it. This was the second time the refrigerator had been moved. Each time a deep, baleful moan was heard just before the movement took place. Preternatural entities can manipulate the physical environment to terrorize their victims. Here the kitchen table tips over as the Warrens watch. In the basement, a bottle of Coca-Cola is levitated. Oh, come on. Like magicians, there's some hidden string. I'm just reading it, friends. Throughout the house, bottles would rise into the air, their caps unscrewed with themselves, and the contents would spill. The hi-fi amplifier at left was part of the second sound system to be destroyed by the infesting entities. See, it's all ripped out and destroyed. When this picture was taken, the recreation room sofa cushions had just been dematerialized. A few hours later, they were found in a closet. Furniture levitating during a demoniac or demonic rampage in the basement recreation room. See, how'd they get these pictures? They were there to exorcise the house. In Lorraine Warren's presence, Brian Donovan's bedroom doors dematerialized. They were later found on the cellar stairs as photographed. These dematerializations would happen in absolute silence. Physical objects would simply be there 1 minute, gone the next. Here the shoes on the floor had been in storage and for some strange reason were placed in this ostensibly walking position. You may say to me, do you believe this? I don't know. I'm just searching like you. My normal instinct is to say it's a crock. Absolute crock. But I also know the respect these people have. I believe them before I believe you're cracked. The recreation room lamp being levitated. Ten minutes before, the room had been in perfect order. Note the plastic garbage can levitating upside down over the pile of furniture. When this photograph was taken, pandemonium was occurring throughout the whole house. And there's the garbage pail levitating. The first time the Warrens visited the Donovan home, Ed inspected the damage done to the basement recreation room. When he climbed back upstairs to the first floor, these bottles of bleach and detergent floated along behind him. Their caps were removed by unseen hands and their contents spilled on the cellar stairs. Now, we'll read about the Donovans, which is the background of this story, if you're interested. But I think that we're going to join Memphis and Dallas. I don't really care whether it's a crawl or a full opening. You got an opening ready? You got one ready? Well, let's just take Dallas and Memphis in with a full opening. Give them the full dignity of joining us. I said to you, I'm a skeptical academician. But I've seen things done by headhunters in northern Luzon, no stranger than this. If you want to get scared, watch a shaman work in Indonesia. I'll be right back. You'll see a lot of phony ghost stories through the Halloween period. I got some real doozaroozies. I started reading some of them last night. I'm looking at a book, The Demonologist, by Gerald Brittle. It's the extraordinary career of Ed and Lorraine Warren. These are not a couple of nuts. The superintendent or commandant of West Point called them in to deal with what might be called a ghost situation. The Amityville Horror, they were the experts on demonology called in. When a home, the Donovan home, began to be terrorized until they were brought to the point of near insanity by strange happenings in their home, Ed and Lorraine Warren were called in. Now, the only reason I throw this around is it's useful here. It isn't useful anywhere. It isn't useful everywhere. When it's useful, I mention it. Not to give me anything other than a little bit of credibility as a non-nut. Now, I dress rather casual, so nobody will take me for a television evangelist. When I'm on this subject, I have to remind you, I did a PhD at Stanford University in philosophies of education. But I don't have a closed mind. And I think it's time that intelligent people look at the subject of demonology and parapsychology. You can't ignore a man like Nostradamus. You can't ignore a man like Edgar Casey. Jean Dixon's pretty good, but she can't hold a candle to Edgar Casey or Nostradamus. Too cold in here now, Mike. Can't you find something in between? Now, we just joined Dallas, Fort Worth, Memphis. We've got a lot of other cities with us. And I'm reading. While they were working on the Amityville horror case, they had a visitation at their house. Will I bore you as I lead up to it again? In an earlier hour, we were looking at automatism, where in a science like, they call them sitters, science like sitting, you receive communications from somewhere, claimed, and you write them. Bly and Allen, ostracized with the Anglican Church in 1907 in an automatism, received communication from a monk, Johann, who died in 1533. What's significant is they received information from him about a giant chapel adjunct to Glastonbury Abbey. And they were ostracized for such witchery. Except archaeologists in later years dug it up in every detail. And old Johann was right. He died in 1533. While working on the Amityville horror case, Ed Warren was in his office. Ed Warren's office is located in a small, cottage-sized... There's no way I can pick this up without laying foundation. You understand that? Stay with me, you that have heard it. Ed Memphis didn't even... weren't even with us yesterday. Ed Warren's office is located in a small cottage. Now, I don't want to get anybody scared. Greater is he that is in us than he that is in the world. Faith and formula conquer the devil. And faith, 90% courage. Fear invites him in. The formula is the power of Jesus' name. Any of you ever see the TV series on Masada? Remember when the guy from Caesar showed up with that little paper in his hand with the seal of Caesar on it? When he waved that, he was Caesar. That was his authority when he arrived at Masada. The seal of Caesar on that document made him the extension of Caesar. He was Caesar there. Jesus' name gives you authority. The problem with most Christians, they don't realize that the warfare is really against principalities and powers, wickedness in high places. But we're studying Atlantis, the pyramid, the Bermuda Triangle, the 35th parallel of the Azores, and we're not closing our mind to the supernatural. Okay? And instead of approaching demonology the way some do, I decided to introduce you to a Catholic demonologist, a layman demonologist. Ed Warren's office is located in a small cottage-sized building. Now, he was making the devil mad if the devil exists, by what he was doing at the Amityville horror situation. Ed Warren's office is located in a small cottage-sized building attached to the main house by a long enclosed passageway. As Ed sat working on preliminary details of the Amityville case that fateful February morning, the latch at the end of the passageway snapped open, followed by the percussive boom of the heavy wooden door. Footsteps then started toward the office. Ed leaned back in his chair, waiting for Lorraine, his wife, to enter with a much-needed cup of coffee. "In here," Ed Warren called out. Long moments passed, however. She didn't appear. "Lorraine!" Ed called out again, but there was no reply. What he heard instead, building in the distance, was an eerie, howling wind. It was not the whistling of wind under the eaves, but rather the menacing roar of a distant cyclone. Goose flesh rose on his arms. "Lorraine!" he asked hoarsely. "Are you there?" Still, no response. As the ominous swirling sound built in power and intensity, Ed quickly thought back over the last few seconds. It then occurred to him that he had heard only three footsteps in the passageway, not the continuous tread of a person walking. Something was wrong. Suddenly, the desk lamp dimmed to the strength of a candle flame, then abruptly the temperature in the office plunged to that of a walk-in freezer. A rank, pungent smell of sulfur rose in the room. Suspicious of the unnatural clamor, Ed Warren opened the desk drawer and withdrew a vial of holy water and a large wooden crucifix. He then got up and walked a few steps out of his office into the anteroom. As he did, there swirled out of the passageway a horrendous, conical whirlwind. Pointed at the bottom, broad at the top, the thing was blacker than the natural blackness of night. Far larger than a man, the swirling black mass moved into the dimly lit room and drifted slowly to Ed's left side and came to a halt some 10 feet away. As Ed watched, it appeared to grow even denser and blacker than it was before. Indeed, within the swirl, he could see that something was beginning to take shape. An entity was beginning to manifest in physical form. As a demonologist, Ed Warren knew he had to act quickly to take the initiative before this fearsome black mass transformed itself into something even more forbidding and dangerous. Holding the cross toward what was now rapidly changing into the macabre hooded specter, Ed Warren stepped forward. The moment he did, however, the entity moved defiantly toward him. Ed stopped, stood his ground, as the form slowly drifted forward. When the swirling black mass was no more than a few feet away, Ed methodically and with absolute determination showered the thing in the sign of the cross with the contents of the holy water vial. Then he spoke the ancient command, "In the name of Jesus Christ, I command you to leave." For eternal seconds, the black mass stayed motionless, no more than a foot away from the cross. Then slowly, it began to back off, though not before giving Ed a clear vision of himself and Lorraine involved in a potentially deadly automobile accident along a highway. Leaving that dreadful vision, the entity withdrew into the passageway from whence it came. An enormous sense of relief came over Ed Warren as he stood, sweating profusely in the freezing, cold room. "Are you going to think I'm a nut for introducing you to this subject? I mean, there's one subject I don't have to teach on. You can just go on glibly through life unaware of any of this. It's okay if that's what you want. And you don't think I'm a nut?" An enormous sense of relief came over Ed Warren as he stood sweating profusely in the freezing cold room. Yet, as he attempted to collect his thoughts, the vicious snarl of fighting animals suddenly erupted outside the house. Immediately, Ed realized there were no animals fighting. The visitation was still in progress. The entity had simply moved upstairs to attack Lorraine, his wife. Avoiding the passageway, Ed flung open the side door to the office and ran up the back steps of the house. He would be too late. Upstairs, Lorraine Warren sat in bed reading. No matter how exhausted, Lorraine nevertheless will not sleep when Ed must work alone late at nights in the office. After a lifetime of work in the supernatural, both Ed and Lorraine Warren know that they are never alone, ever. As Lorraine sat quietly reading, a dreadful pall swept over the room. You know, some of my enemies just get to believing and convincing themselves that I don't believe in the supernatural. And here I go blowing them asunder. I don't believe in nuts. I don't believe in overrating the devil. I don't believe in cheap substitutes for revival and the supernatural moves of God. And I don't believe in silly claims about the devil. I don't think he hides in backward messages and records. And if he does, that ain't important enough for me to waste time on. I don't play records backwards. But I believe that the realm of the parapsychological, the realm of the preternatural, the realm of the supernatural, ought to be considered by intelligent people. As Lorraine sat quietly reading, a dreadful pall swept over the room. Did you ever feel anything like that? It's too hot in here, Mike. Then, setting the book down, she too realized that something was wrong. Very wrong. I was terror-stricken, she says, but I didn't know what I was afraid of. I looked around the room, but nothing was there. I looked down at our two dogs asleep by the bed. They were absolutely motionless, except the hair on each dog from head to tail was standing straight up in the air. Let's run that one by again. I was terror-stricken, Lorraine recalled, but I didn't know what I was afraid of. I looked around the room, but nothing was there. I then looked down at our two dogs asleep beside the bed. They were absolutely motionless. Remember when some guys took on demons in the Bible? And they yelled out at them. Well, Jesus we know, and Paul we know, but who are you? I watched some of those demon deliverers a few years back. We're having them spit them out on napkins. I used to wonder what kind of speed records the deliverer would set if one of those gobs of spit materialized into a real demon. I was terror-stricken, Lorraine recalls, but I didn't know what I was afraid of. I looked around the room, but nothing was there. I then looked down at our two dogs asleep beside the bed. I'd kill those dogs for sleeping. Sleeping through this? Well, I wouldn't kill them. I like dogs too much, but I'd give them away. How could those two dogs sleep through this? Watch dogs. They're like Jesus' disciples. Just watch and pray and they sleep. Watchdogs. I looked down at our two dogs asleep beside the bed. They were absolutely motionless, except the hair on each dog from head to tail was standing straight up in the air. Ought to kick me a dog and said, "Look at your hair." Then out of nowhere, complete pandemonium started up. The swirling black entity that Ed had repelled only a minute before had apparently moved back through the passageway and into the house. The horrendous invader announced its arrival by producing a thunderous pounding noise that sounded to Lorraine like someone beating on sheet metal with a hammer. The violent bashing sound jolted her. Then, within seconds, the heat was totally drawn from the room, leaving Lorraine quaking in the cold. After that, the terrible pounding stopped, and she too heard the swirling sound of the whirlwind coming toward her. What are them damn dogs doing? Through all that pounding. I'd give those dogs to a TV evangelist if they were mine. The menacing, ungodly noise came from the direction of the passageway, one floor below. Terrified, she listened as the whirlwind came up the stairs and swirled into the kitchen, then the dining room, then the living room. Whatever was out there seemed to be searching for me, says Lorraine. What was it? Why was it here? Then instantly, that's where we were, wasn't it? Right there. Whatever was out there seemed to be searching for me, says Lorraine. What was it? Why was it here? Then instantly, now, I tell you what, I'd like to finish this tonight because I'm tired of reading the introduction. I found myself getting mad at the dogs tonight. It was October 1972. The executive officer at the United States Military Academy telephoned the Warrens the day before they were scheduled to present a general lecture to the cadets there. Though the officer's comments were deliberately vague, he nonetheless told the Warrens that a curious security problem had arisen. This is Commandant of West Point, October 1972. Calling the Warrens in to solve a problem. When they arrive there, to skip along, "We'll be glad to help," Ed replied. "Do you know the nature of the problem?" Between us, the major almost broke into a grin. "There's a ghost in the general's quarters. I read to you last night the general's speech. He says nothing macabre has happened here. Nevertheless, a number of incidents have gone on in this house that so far no one has been able to explain to my satisfaction. Some background. In the basement, there's a private study. That room is kept locked and secure. No matter how many times the bunk in there is made up, it's always found ripped apart. Later. Upstairs, ghosts have been seen flitting around the house. These I haven't seen, the general said, but they've been reported for years, and apparently they go with the billet. Now, I wouldn't mention any of this except that we've had an unusual persistent problem. Personal belongings and other important articles are regularly found missing, not stolen," he emphasized, "but missing temporarily. The general stopped for a moment to put on his glasses. Hey, this is not a paid miracle actor at a two-bit sensationalist show. This is a commanding general of West Point. The general stopped for a moment to put on his glasses. I grant you, he says, none of this is terribly important unless you put it into perspective. One of the responsibilities of the commanding officer here is social protocol. In this house, we receive our fair share of government leaders and army brass. Recently, on special occasions, some potentially serious events have occurred. Wallets have been stolen, pockets have been picked, money and personal mementos have been taken from eminent dignitaries and their wives. Later, all the stolen items are found upstairs, neatly laid out on the dresser in our master bedroom. The Warrens sat mum, taking in the unique nature of the problem. This foolishness, the general said in forceful tones, cannot continue. Yet we know that no person has committed these actions. So my question to you, Mr. Warren or Mrs. Warren, is the following. If this is a ghost, and I stress if it is, then you tell me, can a ghost manipulate physical objects? Yes, Ed answered. It can, providing the objects are of no significant weight, such as the ones you describe. All right, then, the general said, does this sound like a ghost to you? Based on what you say, Ed answered. Yes. In fact, it's quite probable that a human spirit is at work here because the items did not disappear completely. Taken aback by the reply, the general looked at Ed for a moment. I guess like he's seeing a ghost. Would you be able to tell if there's a ghost in this house that steals wallets? Lorraine saw this as her opportunity to reply. Sir? Now, I only read that to let you know. I'll get back to it. But these are not nuts. What's your explanation of this? Now, throughout most of my life, I doubt everything. I didn't even believe in God for 3.5 years. I wasn't sure he wasn't there, but I wasn't sure he was either. I mean, I am a hardhead. My first instinct is to say, this is a bunch of crock. But let's pursue it a bit and see. We'll see, won't we? I'm leaving some stations, but I'm not leaving them all. Play I want to know. While we're making this transition, I want to know, do you want me to continue, or is this just not in your cup of tea?